Never get to see it.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United, the most popular movie talk radio show on the internet. Now on iTunes. Tonight, the Movie Geeks welcome the screenwriter behind one of the most eagerly anticipated films of the season, from Sidney Lumet's Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, Kelly Masterson. Plus, he's the acclaimed director of film, stage, and television, whose new big screen effort opens this weekend. The man behind the lens on the new film, The Game Plan, starring The Rock, Andy Fickman. Got a question for the geeks or any of tonight's guests? Give us a call at 718-508-9477. Now, dim the lights, grab the popcorn, and get ready to get your geek on. Here are your hosts for tonight's episode of Movie Geeks United, Jamie, Jerry, and Aaron.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United this Wednesday evening. We got a great show planned for you tonight. My name is Jamie, and my other two co-hosts for the evening are here with us, too. Jerry?
Hey, hey, what's up, everyone?
And Aaron.
Hey, what's up, listeners? How you all living?
Great show for you tonight. Can't wait to get to it. Just a couple of notes right off the top. This Sunday we have a special two-hour tribute shows. You know, we're known for our two-hour tribute shows here. We do once every month. We do one. This time is a little different. We're paying tribute to the 10th anniversary of the DVD format. Speaking to that, we have the esteemed critic from USA Today, Mr. Mike Clark. And we're currently in the confirmation stages for a couple of more terrific guests. Should be a very interesting and enlightening show, and shed some light on the future of the format as well, because, you know, we hear everything about Blu-ray and HD, DVD, and I don't quite understand it. So this is going to be a perfect opportunity to get some expert insight into the future of the medium, as well as the past and present. And also, then we're going to take a week off, and then the Sunday following, we have another exciting show planned. The guest that we have confirmed so far, actor Garrett Dillahunt. He is starring in the one of the featured actors in the new film, The Assassination of Jesse James, and we're very excited about that. And then next month, we're going to bring on the cinematographer of that film and the Coen Brothers films. Mr. Roger Deakins.
Wow.
So we have some great, some great shows planned.
Oscar winner Roger Deakins, I believe.
That goes without saying. That his work is amazing.
Fargo, one of the greatest looking movies of the last 20 years.
Which one is that?
Fargo.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So, how have you guys been doing?
Okay, all right. How are you doing?
Good. I'm glad we can catch up like this.
I'm cool, man.
you can
week on TV, man. Loving it.
You can subscribe to our show via iTunes if you click on the subscribe to iTunes icon on the right-hand side of your Blog Talk Radio screen, or just look up Movie Geeks United on the iTunes search engine. And you can also, on our Blog Talk Radio page, access all of our great archive programs, like our recent interviews with Oscar-winning composer Howard Shore, actor Joe Pantoliano. I still want to say Joey Pants, but I feel like it's disrespectful. And our two-hour tributes to Al Pacino, Brian De Palma, and David Lynch. Just some great programming there. Okay, you guys ready to get started?
Yes.
Okay, yep. Let's do it. In the new film, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, Philip Seymour Hoffman and Ethan Hawke play desperate brothers who calculate a plan to rob their parents' jewelry store. When the robbery goes horribly wrong, the lives of the two brothers and their families are irrevocably changed. The film, which opens in limited release on October 26, also stars Albert Finney and Marissa Tomei, and is brought to the screen by master director Sidney Lumet from a script by first-time feature film screenwriter and acclaimed playwright Kelly Masterson. Mr. Masterson's crafting of this family tragedy with darkly comic overtones has received raves from the country's most revered critics, and Sidney Lumet himself calls it a hell of a story and masterfully plotted. It is our great pleasure to welcome Mr. Kelly Masterson to our program. Mr. Masterson, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi, Jamie.
Hi. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
I'm very excited to talk to you about this film. It's one of my most eagerly anticipated films this season. But tell me a little bit about this story and what inspired you to write it.
Well, a couple of things. The main thing that inspired me to write it was I had read a book which coincidentally has been made into a movie that's also out this fall called Reservation Road.
Mm.
Terrific picture I saw up in Toronto. I was really intrigued by the novel structure. It takes a specific tragic event and it looks at it from a couple different points of view. And I wanted to craft an original screenplay that did the same thing. Take a tragic event and look at it from the points of view of the various participants. And I structured it in, I wanted to structure it in such a way that we could learn the details of the event and the details of these people's life by going backwards and forwards in time. So I had a rather ambitious structure in mind that was somewhat inspired by Reservation Road. And the second thing I was really trying to do when I sat down to start work on that script was I really wanted to explore compulsive obsessive behavior in characters,
mm-hmm.
where they are just sort of drawn along in a series of blunders by their own inability to break their patterns of behavior.
Yeah.
So each of the three main characters in it from the various points of view that we see have a particular compulsion that that just draws them along, and it informs all of their horrible decisions until finally, you know, they meet some sort of tragic end.
Mm.
That was the inspiration for working on the piece.
Well, you couldn't ask for a better cast to bring your script to life.
I absolutely could not ask for a better cast to bring my
script. Yeah. Did you write this with particular actors or a particular director in mind?
No, not really. You know, I always had fantasies about who would play it and who might direct it. And I never dreamed as big as I got. Early on, I really liked the idea of Philip Seymour Hoffman, but oddly not for the part he ended up playing. Early on, when it was in development with a couple of different production companies, they talked about Philip Seymour Hoffman playing the part of Hank that is actually played by Ethan Hawke.
Yeah.
And I was absolutely thrilled with the idea. And when Mr. Lamette came on board, he offered the script to Philip Seymour Hoffman and said, whichever role you want to play, you can play. And Phil chose to do the older brother of Andy.
Mm.
It was an interesting choice, and I didn't understand it at first, but now having seen the film, I just can't imagine anybody else in the part.
He is fantastic. I wonder about that, though, if it's helpful or if it's a hindrance to picture particular actors for the parts you're writing. Do you find that to be helpful or a hindrance?
Yeah, I've done both. Like, for example, on this script, I did not have people in mind. So it really was, my work was informed more by what my goals were and what my agenda was.
Yeah.
And more recently, I've written a script with a very particular actor in mind, and find that it, you know, it drives me because I know that actor's work. It also maybe takes me off course a bit,
yeah.
And maybe it limits me to a certain extent. So there's certainly an advantage and a disadvantage to having someone very particular in mind.
Yeah. Well, the title, it's taken from an old Irish toast.
Yes.
Is it? May you be in heaven a half an hour before the devil knows you're dead.
Yes.
Now, how does that speak to the themes of the story?
Well, the idea, the conceit behind it is all of these people are trying to get away with something. And hopefully they can get away with it, but if they don't, maybe they can still sneak into heaven.
Yeah.
Before the devil knows they're dead. I like the title because it's ironic and it's Irish. I'm Irish. My characters are Irish. But I also love the sort of sense of suspense and ominous overtones that it has. You know, you just might die, and if you do, you know, make sure you get off the earth quickly because the devil is coming for you.
Mm-hmm. It's a terrific title. It just draws you in right away. Now Lumet has said that this is a melodrama in that the story itself defines the characters. Do you agree with that?
To a certain extent, and certainly the way Mr. Lynette explains melodrama, it certainly works with this script. You know, my idea of melodrama has always been the villain you know, the heroine tied to the train track. So when I hear melodrama, I don't necessarily think of this piece.
Right.
But the way he talks about events shaping which directions the characters go, once the story starts rolling along, these characters are just sucked in, and they roll along, and they react. It's not a proactive sort of decision-making process on their part. So from that point of view, and in Mr. Lamette's definition of a melodrama, it is that.
Mm. So how did you get your script into the hands of Lamette?
Well, I've heard three different stories. So
well, tell us yours.
Let me tell you the one I like the most.
Okay, all right.
I don't really know which is true. Brian Lindsay, who is one of the producers, he and Michael Sorenzi had actually optioned it from me and worked on it for a few years before Mr. Lamette got involved, had attached a different director to it who then fell out of the project. And they had some financing in place, and they were looking to quickly attach a new director to it, and they were looking for names. They wanted to get a list of names from Peter Berg at ICM. Peter Berg is Sidney Lumet's agent and also runs ICM. So what they really wanted was a list of available directors. But they figured the best way to ask Mr. Berg that was to call him up and say, we'd like to offer it to Sidney Lumet. And then when Sidney turned it down, then they would say, well, since Sidney isn't available, who is?
Mm-hmm.
But what happened was Mr. Berg got the script to Mr. Lamette, and Mr. Lamette called Brian Lindsay and Michael Sorenzi within a week and said he wanted to do it.
Ah, what a dream.
Yeah, what a dream. Isn't that amazing?
And he's 83 years old. He's made some of the great classic films of all time, and they say that he is just, after viewing this film, he is just as energetic and vital as he's ever been, which is amazing.
Absolutely. Can you imagine what a ride it is for a first-time screenwriter to get someone as legendary and as brilliant as Mr. Lamette to do?
I can't imagine. And especially someone who, you know, I get the sense from him that he has real respect for the writing. But it's very surprising to me. I think I read that he let it slip in an interview last week that he's never actually met you.
Jamie, did you have to bring that up? Yeah, he did. He did say that, and I have been in contact with him since. And we did meet. We met on the set.
Okay.
I guess I'm not all that memorable, but luckily my script is memorable, and he devoted himself, you know, heart and soul to bringing that to life. The only thing I can say to explain that is that what he has told me is that he suffers from tunnel vision, and he is so devoted to getting the work out of the actors and getting
right.
the work in the can that everything else is peripheral.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm happy to be peripheral in his process because of what, you know, the end product of what he's put up there on the screen.
Oh, absolutely. Now you come from a theatrical background, playwriting background, correct?
Yes.
What's the difference between the playwriting discipline and the screenplay form?
Well, I think when I sit down at the computer, I don't think there's a whole lot of difference. It's a different discipline. I have different rules that I have to follow. But as far as my work, I don't necessarily take it. I don't necessarily think there's all that big a difference. The process of getting it from page to final product is enormously different. Theater is so collaborative. The writer is involved, you know, heavily in all aspects of it, and you know, all through the rehearsal process. Whereas with at least my experience on Before the Devil Knows You're Dead is that, you know, I was very involved in the upfront work,
mm-hmm.
and once Mr. Lumette took over the reins, my work was done.
Yeah,
Mr. Lumette took the ball and ran with it after that. So the process, of course, I find very different.
Yeah, do you miss that sense of collaboration when it comes to your film work so far?
Yes, very much. I'm hoping that, you know, second and third time out of the gate, I'm going to be a little more involved and be able to participate more. As a first-time screenwriter, though, especially given, you know, the final product that Mr. Lamette came up with, I have no regrets.
Yeah, and it's definitely for a first-time screenwriter, it's definitely a big leg up.
Yeah,
this is a big prestige project here. Just amazing talent.
Yeah.
Were you always wanting to get into film writing?
No, I wrote for the stage and wanted to write for the stage. Love the theater, and always meant to be that. I wrote a few scripts that had, you know, some limited success in regional theater and off Broadway, and I adapted them to the screen, which sort of gave me that bridge. And had the luck to sell one of them.
Right.
But Before the Devil Knows You're Dead is the first time I took a crack at just writing for the screen. And given the success I've had with it, I guess it was probably a pretty good move on my part.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, tell me a little bit about writing, about the process of writing. First of all, when did you first catch the writing bug? Had you always known that writing was something that you wanted to pursue?
No, I wanted to be an actor. Gosh, I still do. I was a dime a dozen, two-bit actor who came to New York and wanted to make it big, and didn't. So began writing mostly to write stuff for myself and for my friends, and found that I, you know, really, you know, got off on the creative process of creating characters and creating stories, and find that that's, you know, much more satisfying to me than acting ever had been.
Well, it seems like the writing process itself is such a solitary endeavor. Do you relish that during the process of writing?
Yes, I do. I like the solitude of it, and I like you get to be God.
Yeah.
You get to create everything, every decision you get to make. There's always a wonderful moment, hopefully it comes before page 10, where the characters start talking to you.
Yeah.
And you realize that even though you gave it birth, it's alive, it's in your imagination, but it's alive and organic and growing, and you sort of follow that muse as it goes. I like the solitariness of it. I also like very much at the end of the day to have a creative community to share it with.
Mm-hmm.
And I really love the process, the rehearsal process, and seeing it up on its feet.
Yeah. What for you is the most and the least satisfying aspect of the process?
The rewrite? Oh, gosh.
that is, without a doubt.
And that's what they say that writing is rewriting.
Yes, and I'm remarkably lucky on Before the Devil Knows You're Dead because I wasn't subjected to much of that, but in some of my other projects I have been, and yeah, that's the painful part. Now, the most satisfying, I got to tell you, and I've never ever had this before, I got to go to Toronto when we screened up there and to sit in an enormous auditorium with 1,500 really close friends who gasp, and you can feel the tension and the suspense in the air. I've never experienced anything like it. It's absolutely remarkable.
It received raves from Toronto. Everywhere you turn, I just read the Entertainment Weekly write-up where they had two critics giving different perspectives on it, and they were just blown away by the film. What kind of audience reaction have you heard from that screening?
Across the board, excellent, which is mind blowing.
Yeah,
it's an intense piece. It's dark, and so I'm not prepared for it to be embraced quite as warmly as it appears to be so far. I'm thrilled at it. I'm just amazed that it's happening.
Mm. We have a call. Would you like to accept a call?
Sure.
We have a call from a 417 area code. 417, go right ahead.
Hello.
Hello.
My name's Kelly, and I'm 8 years old. Was High School Musical a good movie?
All right. I think that was a prank call. That was our first official prank call. Mr. Masterson, congratulations.
Yeah.
Thank you. I am so honored. And
wow,
I want to
we got
Academy.
We got that. That's wonderful. Actually, that's probably our second prank call, maybe. I'm not sure.
Well, Mr. Masterson, do you think that High School Musical is a good movie? Let's get that out of the way.
I got to tell you, I watched it for what it is. It's terrific.
It's a juggernaut.
Tell me a little bit about the theater business today. Is it in a good state?
I'd like to see more American writers getting some opportunities. I mean, I know that a lot of writers get opportunities out in regional theater, but I'd love to see the more mainstream theater have opportunities for writers. I I came to New York at a time when that was sort of on the wane, and I regret that I wasn't here with Tennessee Williams and all the great writers of the 50s, 60s, 70s.
Right. That's a good point.
When you started the Mr. Messing, this is Aaron, co-host. When you started now transitioning kind of into the screenwriting thing, did you look at certain playwrights who had started straddling both of those worlds? I mean, obviously, the most blatant example is someone like David Mamet.
Or Sam Shepard.
And Sam Shepard, who go back and forth.
Huge fan of both of them. Yeah, as well as Aaron Sorkin, I think.
Aaron Sorkin is another one, yes.
I think when I landed in New York, A Few Good Men was on Broadway.
Yeah.
So I sort of watched him make that transition.
And then, for the last 10 years, I guess the biggest name of the later years of theater, I guess, is someone like Neil LaBute, who goes back and forth. And
also terrific stuff.
And my other question, going back to the screenplay, because I am fascinated by structure, because I have read reviews, and they talk about the ingenious structuring of Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, and that is, was the structure so intact in you that you felt that, that it could not be, moved around, or because the structure is such kind of a pretzel that you could move pieces? I mean, did Mr. Lamette move anything, even if it was minor, or did it stay intact from your original conceit?
Yeah, it pretty much stayed intact. I mean, Mr. Lamette added quite a bit of his own touches and his own writing. He made a couple of important changes in terms of relationships in the script, but the structure he pretty much left alone. I don't think that it's unmovable, and I've also given some thought to some comments that I've read about it, perhaps being able to be told just in a straight storyline. And I think it actually could. I think what drew me to it was to just keep, look at it as if it was a little bit of a kaleidoscope. I just wanted to keep changing the angle each time a little bit. It was, and once I committed to it, that became my entry into it. I don't know that that it's an absolute, and that it could not have worked any other way.
And I got to ask this on a studio standpoint, on notes of some sort. I mean, because it is a great title, and it's an unusual title, and anyone who cares about movies will know that that's a memorable title. But studios being studios, I'm curious, was there ever even one discussion of could you call it The Heist?
You know, I was really lucky that way too, because it was a title that I loved from the very beginning, and so the answer to the question is no. Although I had it with a production company very early on, who said that once we get this shot, we're going to have to change the title, and it broke my heart. I'm glad it never happened.
Because you can just imagine someone in the studio saying, "Well, it's not going to fit on the marquee. All we're going to get is Because on the marquee and." The heist would be, or the devil's heist. How about that? Let's compromise.
Mr. Master said, "Can you give us any sense of what's coming up next for you? You say that you're writing on a new project."
This is such a wonderful ride that Mr. Lamette and the producers and this wonderful cast have set me on. I quit my day job.
Always a good thing.
Shortly after we wrapped the last summer, and I've been writing for the last year. Got several new spec scripts, working with a terrific manager, looking for a new agent out in L.A., and hope that that I can sell one of the new scripts.
Well, I wish you the best of luck.
Good luck. Congratulations.
With Before the Devil Knows You're Dead and all your future endeavors. And please come back to us anytime you'd like in the future.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Jamie, Jerry, and Aaron.
Yeah.
That's right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Best.
Good luck with it. Thank you.
Thanks. Goodbye.
Bye-bye. All righty, that is Kelly Masterson, screenwriter of the upcoming Sidney Lumet film, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. I think we have a number that I recognize here.
Okay, that's good. One you recognize. It's High School Musical, 8-year-old stuff.
863 area code. Is this Chris?
Yeah, I want to talk about High School Musical 2, which I think was largely inferior to High School Musical 1.
And most sequels are inferior.
Yeah.
Wait, I thought you were going to call up and talk about my first teacher or something. Okay, never mind.
So how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
How's everything going?
Good good interview, with the exception of the small little hiccup in there.
You never know, you know, and I try not to pay too much attention to the switchboard once I patch the guest in, because I'm always biting my nails every time I press that
right
key, but that's the one thing you just can't control, you know.
What could motivate that? Like, I've got nothing better to do on a Wednesday night than call in to, you know.
Well, what about that guy?
Show.
Remember a couple months ago we had the guy
call in
and tell, what's good? What's good to see?
Yeah.
Like, what?
Now, at least that was, like, bizarre and really out there, and we didn't know if it was a prank phone call or not. This was just, you know, completely... You know,
yeah,
it was moronic, and you know, had no purpose.
Moronic being the key word there.
So, Chris, have you read these reviews like I have of this Before the Devil Knows You're Dead film?
Yeah, I have, and I actually hadn't really known anything about it until you told me about it, and now, of course, I really want to see it.
Yeah, October 26th can't get here soon enough.
I mean, we could have just had an interview with a possible Oscar-nominated screenwriter. There's a possibility he could get it. That's
very true.
That is very true. And especially under Sidney Lumet's hands. I mean, you know.
And Lumet works so rarely. When he comes out, it's got to be something.
Yeah, I like Lumet. He's very rarely does he do something that doesn't, you know, leave some sort of impact on me. Even the smaller films.
Even the Vin Diesel movie, what was it called?
Find Me Guilty. You got to say, that's for a Vin Diesel film, that's a step up.
Yeah, I mean, it was really entertaining and like extremely watchable movie for what it, you know,
for
it
what it is.
Faults, but it was still much better than anything else he's ever done.
It was
Vin Diesel, not
early Lumet's early '80s output is when he kind of had his you know, kind of his lost period, when we got, you know, Garbo Tarps, you know, and Daniel.
Oh, actually, those are, I was reading his book, and he has very, you know, and I went back and revisited. I always like Garbo Talks, even though it's not really Garbo in the film. I thought it was an entertaining film. Daniel is actually, isn't that based on the E.L. Doctorow novel, The Book of Daniel?
Yeah, and about...
Actually, that's not a bad film. And Death Trap, they're actually very entertaining films.
I like Death Trap. I actually think Running on Empty
is superb.
It's the
very
superior version of the Daniel story, basically.
And Night Falls on Manhattan.
Night Falls on Manhattan
absolutely
is excellent.
Q&A.
And I'm crazy about The Verdict. I've always been crazy about The Verdict.
Yeah, I don't think he's ever... I wouldn't even call those, like, you know... It may be a little, you know, obviously below par with the stuff he was cranking out in the 70s, but still there's
But
there's a master behind that camera.
Q&A with Nick Nolte and Timothy
Hutton. Oh, Q&A is superb.
It's just it's a lost classic. Q&A
and all of these films across the board, they're most notable for their performances.
Yes, great performance.
He draws just exceptional performances.
I thought Q&A was one of the highlights in Nick Nolte's career the last 20 years, without a doubt.
Armand
Asante hasn't. The problem is Armand Asante is a very good actor. Sadly, very few directors are able to get that out of him. Lumet was one of those who did.
Well, what they're saying about Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, and this makes sense under Lumet's hands, is that it has a real mix between a kind of Dog Day Afternoon feel and a Eugene O'Neill family tragedy.
Yeah,
and
also...
He's directed O'Neill as well.
Yeah.
Long Day's Journey in the Night.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty... I mean, it's probably one of the most draining films you'll ever see, ever on film. It's just it's remarkable, though.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's our take on Sidney Lumet.
All right. He's
great
man.
He
can come on anytime he wants.
And I loved his, and his TV show was a lot of fun. That 100 Center Street.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
A&E was a really fine show.
That's right. Chris, we're about to interview Andy Fickman, who is the director of The Game Plan, the upcoming movie with The Rock. And this is something that might excite you, like it excited me. He was also a producer on Anaconda.
Oh, that's awesome, man.
I know. Well, we finally get to talk to somebody about Anaconda.
Well, maybe he can speak to what we have known all along, which is that it was meant to be that John Voight's interpretation of that project was where it was meant to be.
One of the great comic performances of the past 20 years.
One of the great punchlines in the last 10, 15 years with the wink.
Yeah, I mean that's...
Wink, the famous wink.
Yeah.
Or infamous wink, whatever.
There's so many little tics and things that he has in that movie, and he seems to be the one that's in on the joke. I mean, that's just the sense I get from it. He's having a great time, and it just is so infectious in that movie.
It's the kind of movie that has one line, you know, a line like monkey blood.
Or the great Ice Cube line. Let's make that out of that big.
That is great. I won't do my Paul Sorona impression tonight.
Okay, that's that would be good. I don't mind.
All right, Chris, thank you for calling in, man. And we have our two-hour tribute show to DVD format this Sunday. So, join us for that.
Yes, I will.
Yes, please do.
All righty, man. I'll talk to you later. Thank you,
Chris.
All right.
Bye-bye. Okay, so we've had an interesting show so far. Great first guest, Mr. Masterson, and official prank call.
The prank call. But it's good that because we're one of the first, you know, people to really get Mr. Masterson's name out there. So this
could
is pretty historic, I think. So.
Like I said, these last 15 years of playwriters going into screenwriting, you know, Sorkin, LaBute. I mean, Masterson could be, the next biggie. So
he could be.
We got him early.
It seems like a really good training ground for, I don't know if that's the appropriate term to use, but to go into feature film writing, because those writers that you just mentioned, those are the tops in film today. I mean, Aaron Sorkin, can anyone write like that? I mean, he's amazing. I could listen to his dialogue for days and days.
No one else and no one should.
Yeah. All right, our next guest is up and ready to go. He is a multi-talented director of film, stage, and television, whose credits include Who's Your Daddy?, She's the Man, and Reefer Madness, the movie musical. And yes, he was an associate producer on Anaconda, as I mentioned earlier, one of the great underappreciated classics of the past 20 years. And he's probably thinking that I'm being sarcastic, but I'm absolutely not. His new film, The Game Plan, starring Dwayne The Rock Johnson, opens in theaters everywhere this Friday. It is a great pleasure to welcome writer, producer, and director Andy Fickman to our show. Mr. Fickman, are you there?
I am there. Thanks, guys.
Mr. Fickman, thank you so much for being with us tonight. I'm
First
very excited.
First of all,
to
it's
talking.
Andy. No, Mr. Fickman. Got
okay, cool. Well, welcome to the show, Andy.
If I keep hearing Mr. Fickman, I feel like I'm walking into that set on Dateline to Catch a Predator. And immediately I get a little awkward.
Well, actually,
wait, is this something you're not telling us?
Well, I'm just hoping that the broadcast doesn't lead to the authorities finding me.
Oh,
this
wow.
This is actually a sting.
I'm very excited about The Game Plan and all the great, wonderful clips I've been seeing on television and all the great reviews I've been reading of it. But first of all, tell me about your journey into filmmaking. You have a strong theater background, is that right?
Yeah, I came out of Texas, and I was directing a lot of theater there and graduated. And the quick one, too, is I moved to Hollywood not knowing literally anybody, and I got a job at Universal Studios as a tour guide, still the hardest job I think I've ever had. And then from there I went into a mailroom at an agency called Triad, which has now been absorbed by the William Morris Agency, but it was a great training ground to get a kind of behind the scenes. And from there I started doing development for an amazing actor named Gene Wilder.
Wow.
And I was with Gene at a production company called Palmel Productions for several years. And while that happened, I helped form a theater company called Fountainhead Theater Company in Los Angeles with a bunch of unknowns like Molly Shannon and Anne Heche and Ron Livingston and John Lee Hancock.
Well, it's
a pretty great group of people, Andrew Schaefer. And then so I went from I would do my Hollywood day job of development, and then at night I'd go to the theater and direct. And then I left Gene's company, and I did the similar job heading development for another great actress, Bette Midler.
Mm,
so
wow.
I was with Bette for several years at her company, All Girl Productions. I was the all boy at All Girl. And then from there, again, continued all with my theater, and then I went to a company run by an amazing woman named Verna Hara, called Middle Fork Productions, where we did, in fact, do Anaconda. And I actually, listen, I love the fact that people love Anaconda. We had a lot of fun with it, and we were really pleased with what it was. And
it was a lot of fun to watch.
It's a silly romp, but that's what we were going for.
Now, Anaconda is one of my... my treasures from the past, 10-15 years.
Well, listen, if you look at the cast, Mindy Marin, our casting director, did a phenomenal job, but that is a movie that had Jennifer Lopez, Ice Cube, Owen Wilson,
yeah.
John Voight, Eric Stoltz. I mean, that was a really amazing
cast. It's a big deal.
Yeah.
It's a big deal. When that came out, that was a highly anticipated film, and it was a lot of fun.
And we were very lucky, Columbia, we ended up, we were number one at the box office 2 weeks in a row, and it really was, at the time, I'm not sure people really knew what to expect, and J-Lo, this was very early in her career.
Yeah.
I think, probably Voight and Stoltz were our two biggest names at the time. Owen Wilson had just come off Bottle Rocket. And Cube was, coming off the height of Boys in the Hood. So it really was a great time. A hard movie to make, but a lot of fun.
Well, I have just two questions about Anaconda,
sure.
Because I'm just so excited to be able to talk to you.
First of all, I have to say, I can't tell you how many times on this press tour for the game plan that at some point somebody on the press was like, can I just ask you an Anaconda question?
And oh, wow, good. I'm not alone.
I was loving that.
first of all, I'm very interested in this. You were an associate producer on Anaconda.
Yeah.
You see all these titles, associate, executive, regular producer. What are the differences between...
I didn't start as associate producer, and at the time I was heading, my title was Senior Vice President of Development for Middle Fork. Mm-hmm. Anaconda was a script that I found from an agent, brought it into our production company, helped drive it over to Columbia not literally, I think we used a messenger service, but I helped get it set up at Columbia Pictures, and really, from a development standpoint, a lot of times as an executive, you do a ton of work, but you're just never given anything for the work. That's the job you were hired to do. And Anaconda was such a thing for me. It was such the type of movies that I grew up loving, like Jaws. That I was sort of the relentless one, and during the course of it, where I continued to stay on the set and stay in production and be very hands on. Both Verna Hara as a producer and Columbia Pictures, the people over at Columbia, they all sort of said to me, you know what, you've earned your producer stripes on this one.
Mm.
So it was a really nice, it was an unexpected treat, and it was a great way to help move to the next level of my career as well.
Oh, absolutely. And my last question about Anaconda. John Voight... In that film, I think it's one of the great comic performances. And do you have any stories or any observations?
Yeah, well, I will say that the actual scriver, John Voight is a genius actor, and he was coming off the movie Rosewood at the time, and actually had very limited time. I think a few conversations. Our director Lucho Llosa, who had done Sniper and Specialist, But there was a few conversations, but in the script as written, that character was like a bad, like an asshole from Chicago.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sorry, can I curse?
You can say whatever you like.
All of a sudden, I rocked the asshole, and then I just thought that I just apparently cost you guys millions upon millions of dollars.
No. Go right ahead.
You gave us listeners.
So at that point, it was he was just a guy. I think the character was this asshole out of Chicago and had his backstory. We get there to the set, and John had started talking to the hair and makeup people. He had an idea for a scar and all of them. And then we're filming. We actually filmed the movie on the Amazon, on the Rio Negro. I mean, we were deep in a place called Manaus where they did Fitzcarraldo. I mean, it is a crazy, crazy place. And so normally when you have the ability to get your dailies to the studio, it truly is the notion of within a day or at least 2 days. Now you're talking about shipping footage from the middle of the Amazon to Columbia Pictures. So you're talking a couple of days delay, and here's John stepping out of the trailer, and he has this accent, and he has this scar, and he has a backstory that he just starts pitching, which is, well, my parents are from Paraguay. They were ex-Nazis, and they moved to the jungle, and I've actually fought the snake, and this is what the scar is, and he's going on and on and on, and he's got this accent, and the director's like, okay, yelling action. You know, 4 days later, Columbia's like, oh, hey, we're looking at dailies. What the hell happened to the guy from Chicago? We don't actually know anything about this guy in this Paraguay. Like, when did this happen? And I think John, as an actor, really sort of did a good job of convincing him that he had a handle on this character and to trust him. And it really turned out, you know, even if there were doubters along the way, and it really turned out to cut together great. And certainly the critics, if, you know, whether they loved or hated the movie, there seemed to be a universal feeling of appreciation for what John did. As a matter of fact, Siskel and Ebert both commented that they felt that John should have gotten an Academy Award nomination, because they said for the notion of what a supporting character does, they like, you know, this is to us what a great supporting character actor here is. He's creating a character that is so larger than life, and we feel that's what the Academy should nominate. Apparently, the Academy did not get the message that Anaconda should be nominated, but we appreciated Siskel and Ebert.
Well, it's not the first time the Academy...
Apparently, the memo did not make it all the way.
Yeah.
Now, okay, enough about Anaconda. Now, the movie musical, I want to talk to you a little bit about this, because it's experienced a real resurgence in the past few years.
And yeah.
You directed Reefer Madness for the stage and then for a filmed version.
Uh-huh.
What were the challenges of making that transition?
Well, there were several. You know, Los Angeles, we started it as a musical here in L.A. and ended up sweeping every possible West Coast Theater Award you could imagine. And it really was like a very homegrown Rocky Horror Picture Show-esque musical. But the fact that we not only swept all the awards, but while we were in L.A., it became, you could look in the audience of our tiny little theater, and every week it was Warren Beatty, Keanu Reeves, Benson. I mean, it was a who's who of Hollywood coming to see us.
Hmm.
And then we transferred. We were purchased by the Nederlanders to go off Broadway in one of the biggest opportunities given. And we, of course, opened about 4 days after 9/11 in New York. So naturally, as you can imagine, the city certainly wasn't ready to celebrate all things Reefer Madness. It was a rough time to be in New York, no matter what. Harder to be opening a play when the last thing people wanted to do was go to theater. So we sort of died in New York. We sort of thought the show was done. And then Bob Greenblatt, who had just taken over as the head of Showtime and really responsible for everything from Tudors to Californication to Weeds, all the resurgence that Showtime has had has all been under Bob's tutelage. And Bob had been a huge fan of the stage play in L.A., and he called us maybe, I think, literally day two of being there. We went in and met, and he said, let's do our Rocky Horror Picture Show. And he gave me an opportunity to use a lot of my original cast. But at that time, Kristen Bell, who had not done Veronica Mars yet, Kristen had joined my show. She was a student at NYU, so I cast her when I was in New York.
Mm-hmm.
So, but now the timing was right that she was slowly emerging, and we put Nev Campbell, whose brother Christian Campbell had been in the show from the very beginning, and we added Alan Cumming and Anna Gasteyer and Steven Weber. And I really, in some ways, it was the best of all worlds, because I got to make the movie the same way that I got to make the play. So I had no constraints. The music, my partners, Kevin Murphy and Dan Studney, we were like kids in a candy store, and a rarity in film when you have that much support from the head of a studio.
Yeah.
You have the challenges of making a musical are huge, because you're not just making, obviously, you know, it's hard enough to make a movie. Now add 16 production numbers, add recording every sort of song, add all of the elements that's going to be, and hoping that you get it right. The end result was we got nominated for multiple Emmys. We ended up winning an Emmy Award. We won the the Premier Audience Jury Award at the Deauville Film Festival. We won numerous other sort of international satellite award. Like, we were so thrilled with what the reception finally was, and we got to premiere at Sundance, And no greater way to go to Sundance than having the fact that your movie is already bought. So you're surrounded by nervous filmmakers who have put their homes up and hoping that there's somebody comes
right.
in. And we're going in literally like having cappuccinos, like, la, 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 I'm in Sundance skiing and getting swag. And really, nobody has to buy my movie. We're not even in competition, but we're the premiere. We're having our big premiere at the Eccles Theater, the main theater. The place was packed. It was truly a remarkable, remarkable experience.
Oh, you just can just sit back and enjoy the experience. That's incredible.
You know, and I had several friends who were filmmakers who truly did have the house up for mortgage.
Yeah.
And had their film in competition. And, you know, I feel horrible because we'd be doing the same amount of press. But, again, mine was, you know, via Showtime helping to be, like, pick up the van. And I'd run into them, and they'd all be, like, huddled in the back of, like, a used VW, you know, like eating one Ritz cracker and being like, you know, if the movie doesn't sell, I have to come live with you forever.
So tell me about the game plan. How did the opportunity to direct the game plan come to you?
I had just finished a movie with Amanda Bynes called She's the Man.
Oh, yeah.
That had been out, and actually we hadn't even released at that point, but there was a nice, you know, as these things sometimes work, there seemed to be a nice buzz building in town. Some people had seen it from various studios, and opportunities were coming my way. And I just started reading a bunch of scripts, and I have a 10-year-old. So the notion of doing a movie that was just pure family entertainment, whereas Reefer Madness was certainly something that my son couldn't enjoy.
Right.
So I have to say there was endless times over the course of, like, kindergarten where we'd get the call from the principal saying, is it possible your kindergartner could not mention Reefer Madness 40 times a day? because it's been a hard time explaining to the kids exactly what Andy's, what his daddy does for a living. All of our paraphernalia, you know, everything with Reefer Madness was a bong, was like, you know.
Oh, wow.
So it was like play dates were always about, you know, can you hide everything in the closet every time a child comes over? and I've always said, you know, nothing that he can appreciate now, but of course the kid will turn 12 or 13 and dad will be like, put all that Reefer Madness stuff up. And he'll be the coolest kid in the neighborhood, except for all the parents will hate him. So She's the Man, which was very much aimed at, like, a teen girl audience, and so even that was a little bit more, you know, out of his wheelhouse. And then here I'm reading this story that I grew up in Texas, so the idea of doing a football movie, and there was all this kind of great elements of ballet, and I thought the fun of the choreography of what I had experienced with Reefer Madness, and it was Disney. And, you know, if you're going to do a family entertainment, nobody does family movies better than Disney. I mean, for me, just thinking back growing up as a kid and thinking of Disney, this was just a great opportunity.
So tell me about the working relationship with Disney, their level of collaboration with the director.
Really, like, you know, I had heard probably, like, from a lot of people that, you know, you're getting ready to go into this factory and kill yourself before you go in, and I had had the benefit that when I was working with Bette Midler, our production deal was actually at Disney. So I had been an executive on a movie at Disney called Hocus Pocus. I had been an executive on a movie with Chevy Chase called Man of the House with Jonathan Taylor Thomas. So I had certainly gone through, from an executive standpoint, Disney. But as a director, I guess I probably went in bracing myself for some sort of battle that just never came. And as a matter of fact, the president of Disney, Oren Aviv, my executive, Brigham Taylor, they and Todd Morata, these guys honestly were such great collaborators. I felt like I'd had such a great experience at DreamWorks during She's the Man, such a great experience at Showtime. So here I am kind of finally waiting for where it's going to be the Battle Royale, and it just never came. They were really decent and understood, you know, they understand their brand. So
yeah.
So you are, you know, you when you are having a conversation with them about who their target audience is for a Disney movie, they've got a lot of experience that helps sort of guide you in terms of it. And even then, you know, the one thing I told them I didn't want to make was, I didn't want to make The Pacifier in the, you know, in the broadest sense of the words.
Right.
I was more intrigued by something that would fall closer to maybe Without a Boy. I was more intrigued to do something that was a little bit edgier or darker, and certainly working with The Rock, I was going to be able to explore some of it. And every step of the way, Disney was just, they were very supportive. Actually, The Rock and I've spent all day. We are in prep right now. We're going to do a big reimagination of Escape to Witch Mountain.
I read that, yeah.
We're starting to film that at the top of the year, and even that, like I said, I don't want to do a kids' adventure movie, and Disney is allowing me to make a completely kick-ass action thriller that has nothing to do with being geared at kids, but doing just an amazing kick-ass version of Witch Mountain. And I feel like, you know, if you can find that level of relationship with your executives and you can find that camaraderie with them, you know, the sky's the limit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
oh, yeah.
That's
hold
great.
On to that.
And I'll also say I think that maybe my approach is, you know, when I come to the director's cut, where normally I think a lot of directors shut the executives out and I'll see you in 10 weeks when you can look at my movie, and I have an open door policy during editing. I let the head of the studio and everybody, I got nothing to hide. If you want to come and spend a couple hours with me when I'm editing and want to see where I'm going, if you want to offer an opinion, offer an opinion. I got nothing, I'd rather you sit and be a part of my process and collaborate with me and communicate with me than the sort of classic, here's my movie, take it or leave it, because mm-hmm. I find when that happens, everyone has an opinion. We all, you guys will look at game plan and there'll be something you might like, something you won't like. That's the subjective nature of watching movies. Mm-hmm. So the same thing as an executive, they're going to have an opinion, and some of it might be valid, some of it might not be, but when you're doing it under the less pressure cooker of it's a cut movie, and now you're giving me 400 pages of notes, I'd rather do it when I'm still discovering the movie in the edit.
Right.
And that way I can talk it through with you. And I can, if I'm passionate for it, I'm going to convince you otherwise. And if you're passionate for it, there's every reason to assume that you'll convince me that, you know what, that's the right way to think.
Yeah, and it makes for a better, it would have to make for a better film.
Yeah.
I think what it makes, I feel like at the end it's a movie that everybody can love and embrace. And when we started testing, our test numbers, and you can love and hate the idea of these sort of testings, but our test numbers had been some of the highest Disney had in years.
Yeah.
And I think that is a direct relationship of that sort of collaborative effort.
Yeah.
And your tracking is ahead of the kingdom, the other release this weekend. I read that today, that the awareness for the game plan is head and shoulders above that film.
It's been pretty remarkable, and I think going back to what we said about Disney, you know, when it comes to if you're going to do a family film, who do you want to market it? Boy, howdy, Disney knows how to reach families, even with the use of Disney Channel, Disney.com. And
yeah.
And I think if they love the movie as Dick Cook and Bob Iger and Oren Aviv and all the heads of the studio have really embraced this film, I feel like they are getting behind the movie.
Mm. Tell me a little bit about The Rock. Obviously, you've gotten along great with him in your collaboration with him. You're doing it again, but he has an incredible amount of charisma and presence, and
yes, he does.
He's building up to be just a fantastic actor.
He's a big girly man. Take him down. I've been on a press tour with him for 2 weeks. I'll tell you a couple things about The Rock.
Okay.
He's a lousy kisser. He hogs the pillows every morning to have to wake up and shave that chest. Who needs it? You know what? Scorsese doesn't shave DiCaprio. At least I don't think so. He is, you know, the minute that I was told, you know, go and sit down and meet with The Rock, you know, I have this image of like, you know, I think he's, you know, from what I've seen, I think that, you know, I liked what he did in Be Cool. I thought that he was a lot of fun in Rundown. I especially liked when he hosted Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
But I had this image of like, I'm going to go sit down with The Rock. I'm a guy who comes out of directing theater and working with Gene Wilder and Bette Midler, like, I'm not sure what our conversation is going to be. Like, I don't, like, you know, do I mention, like, the, you know, Terry Funk and the Funk Brothers of wrestling? Or where am I going with this? And I sat down, and honestly, before he said even hello, he said, I just got to ask you a question. What are your thoughts on Elvis Presley? And I said, well, I grew up in Texas. I love Elvis. And he said, no. I mean, do you actually really know anything about it? Like, he didn't want to just hear the basic throwaway. And we spent an hour talking about Elvis and his movies and his music, which was a crucial part that was layered into our movie in the game plan. But I wish I could find the one bad thing about him. And having the opportunity to work with so many actors, you know, sometimes you walk away from an actor and you're like, that's a very talented actor, but that actor is very troubled. Or
right.
That's a talented actor, but God forbid they're on the call sheet for first thing in the morning because they're not good in the morning.
Mm.
Dwayne is, he truly is as committed to this as a craft. This is not a hobby for him. This is a career that he has long wanted. And his dedication to the cast and crew is just unparalleled. And as you can imagine, when you're coming off something like this and you're talking about what your next movie is going to be, you know, I don't think you dive into doing your very next movie with the same star unless you just came off such an experience that made you think, God, I can't wait to spend another year with this guy.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
and
yeah.
And I feel like the charisma and, you know, we talked about this a lot on the press tour, too, which is, the guy is a movie star in that sense that, you know, there's plenty of actors I'm sure you guys can name off, too, that are great actors, but no matter what, the audience doesn't race to see them or the audience can't watch their performance and feel connected to them.
Right.
This guy has a relationship with the audience. He genuinely feels like they can connect. And on the press tour, I've just never seen that many people just so excited to meet this guy, just even from the press alone. And
you're right. It's an
unusual experience.
Yeah, it's one of those intangible things that you know he's a movie star.
Yeah, you know, we talk about people like, you know, those great, like the Steve McQueens and all of these guys who are these kind of iconic imagery. And I honestly believe Dwayne has a kid's view of, like, he's just so thrilled and excited and humble. We'd walk out of a set. We filmed in Boston, and it's a great city and a tricky city to film in, too. It's not built on the notion of filming movies. And we'd walk out of a location, and there'd be 300-400 fans lined up screaming The Rock's name. And, you know, this is a guy who would take the time. He'd look at me and be like, can I just have a few minutes? And he'd run across the street and sign as many autographs, pose for as many pictures, just because his fans had taken the time to show up and had been waiting in the cold for 3 hours. He's not a guy who's just whipping up the hand and, like, giving the wave or
ducking
under the Escalade. This is a guy who feels like he's there because of these people. That's who he wants to connect with.
That's great.
It made me feel completely horrible about myself. Mainly because I noticed that nobody was yelling, Thickman!
I yelled at my assistant.
I forced my assistant to stand outside with one crappy camera and yell Thickman and take my picture, and then I ducked into the Escalade.
Now, you mentioned Witch Mountain,
yeah.
And I want to talk to you about another one of your future projects.
Sure.
Very, very briefly. We had a chance to speak with Allison Burnett.
Yeah.
And he's the screenwriter of the new Fame film that you're directing. Where are you guys at with that project?
You know, we're in the, you know, the Hollywood speak is we're in talks.
Okay.
This is a project that we have been in discussions about for some time, predating Allison. The producers are the same producers of She's the Man in terms of Lakeshore and the people over at MGM, just some great, great people behind this project, Mark Canton. And Fame is probably one of my all-time favorite movies, and Alan Parker's, what he did with Fame and Commitments, I mean, I'm so in awe of this guy. And I think I've always stated with Fame that I'm honored that they have come to me to discuss this. I don't ever want to do a movie that in any way would be less than what Mr. Parker did.
Right.
And I certainly don't want to do the thing that almost the wah-wah feeling of, like, oh, Fame 2007, wah-wah. Like,
right.
Like, here's what you can do. Go spend 2 hours and watch the original.
Yeah.
Watch Coco take off her shirt and cry will be better than anything on this version. And
right.
So I think that at this stage, and Al's certainly one of the great screenwriters in Hollywood right now. So we're in those talking stages to see if we're on the same page creatively, and B, are we on the same page with a deal, and finally, are we on the same page timeline? Because as it goes, you know, we are an industry right now that is bracing for the potential of a strike.
Yeah,
right.
And we are. We're in a weird universe of having conversations that are, you know, for a strike that doesn't exist, we have conversations that are pre-strike and post-strike. Mm-hmm. And if I can do one movie, which is legitimately as the director, I'm only going to be able to get one movie out before the strike. And right now that clearly seems to be Witch Mountain, as that's where we're, you know, we have a start date and we're kind of racing, you know, those deals are done and the energy there. So then it becomes a question of, you know, is fame going to be available for me? Is fame going to wait for me? And is fame going to be the movie I want to do?
Yeah.
All of that is what we're in the exploring right. But I will say that if it all comes together and if I am lucky enough to be the director of Fame, I guarantee that my version of Fame will be in complete honor of what Mr. Parker did and will never feel like a sequel to and never feel like a remake of, but will hopefully live in its own universe.
Absolutely. It's an exciting project, and definitely keep us posted on that.
Oh, by all means.
The game plan opens this weekend. Are you going to sneak into some regular showing?
You know, we've had the pleasure of being able to get out and see some of these advanced screenings, and we've been having such a blast doing that. And, yeah, I think this weekend we will be doing it. My son has actually organized a premiere on Saturday where I have 10 of his friends, and we are doing we have an entire, you know, it's the game plan premiere in the middle of Universal Studios, I think, to see the movie. So I for sure will be seeing it with a real audience, and I love – to be honest, there's nothing greater. The worst audience to see at your movie is a Hollywood audience.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you know, it's there's nothing more jaded than people who get paid to work in the business. It's always the joke of like when you go on location and you go to a city, any place else other than Hollywood to go, like, you know, rent a house in a neighborhood. These people are so excited to rent to Hollywood. You try to go to any neighborhood in Hollywood and rent a home where people in Hollywood work and live. They're the first to be like, "Oh, I do not want a film crew."
Yeah, that's very true.
Horrible.
Yeah.
I don't want you near. So I feel like when you watch a movie, that we were very lucky. Sunday we had the premiere and the place was very rowdy. And Monday night we were able to have our cast and crew screening at the El Capitan the response has been great, but I love just seeing with an audience that has no preconceived notions. They've spent their money, they've put down their dollars, and they want to be entertained. That's what I want to see, if whether or not I did the job of entertaining them.
Absolutely. Well, we can't wait. The game plan opens this weekend. Andy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Andy.
And I look forward when we, as we get down the road with Witch Mountain, let's do it again.
Let's do it.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
All right, guys. Have a great time.
You too.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
That is director Andy Fickman, The Game Plan, starring The Rock, his film.
Real cool dude.
Yeah, he's really a great interview.
Very nice. Very nice.
From Texas. I got to give props to that.
Two fantastic guests tonight.
It was a wonderful show tonight. Wonderful.
Special thanks to Tiffany Littleton for our tremendous opening announcement, as usual. And we will be back with you Sunday evening for our two-hour tribute to the DVD format.
Until Sunday.
I guarantee it's going to be awesome.
It's going to be great. It's going to be great. All right, guys. We will see you then. Thanks for joining us, everybody.
Thank you. Good night, everyone. Bye-bye.
Good night.